So let's follow up and bring us up to date on this lady. What happened?
Sure. So, you know, it's nice to hear my colleagues kind of practice similar to me. It's always reassuring. So, you know, I think when a patient comes and is referred in from a community oncology practice to see me, you know, my job as the expert is to sit there and spend a little bit more time than what they would in clinic and make sure the patient understands all the treatment options and ramifications of that. And so, like my colleagues, I spent time educating her regarding the different therapies. I am a high-dose IL-2 center, so we discussed high-dose IL-2, we discussed watch and wait, we discussed VEGF TKIs and clinical trial options. She was of the mindset that she was not interested in high-dose IL-2. I usually told myself when I offered that at my institution that I would never force a patient into that treatment, which, you know, as a doctor, we can really force them down that path. I would instead inform them, tell them I think they're an appropriate candidate for it if they choose, and then give them information so they can go and read on and make their own decision. So she had been doing that. She contacted KCA. She's been on the different websites and was able to interact in support groups and realized that that was not an appropriate therapy.
What was her kind of life situation? What was she doing?
You know, she has older kids. She has a couple children. They're in their mid-20s, and she's married and she's a homemaker.
What was her kind of overall attitude about where things were heading, and how did that contribute to this decision about the IL-2?
Well, I think she, just like most patients in this situation, newly diagnosed, worried about early death, but still hoping for cure, and having to realize that cure is most likely not an option for her, though in talking about also the uniqueness of her cancer, that she has low volume disease. Several of the lesions in the lung may not even be cancerous, but will operate like they all are. But in the ability, depending on outcome, that carrot hanging there, which may be extremely rare and hardly ever we see, to do something aggressive. You know, if she had a phenomenal response to therapy and one could intervene with doing metastectomies on her little nodules and things. So I try to make sure my patients understand the uniqueness of their cancer. Different conversation than obviously someone that was symptomatic or had large volume disease. So I really believe in being honest with patients and allowing them to have a feeling of hope that they're going to get something meaningful out of treatment. But I clearly state the goals are always going to be quality of life driven and on survival and longevity. And so that's how we make our treatment choices. So she's indicated to me that she's, you know, like my colleagues, we talk about watchful waiting. We talk about that the real reason to change or to start therapy, initiate therapy, would be based upon significant progression. And it's all how you define significant. And so I tell patients, I use the sleep test with them, which is, you know, are you up at night worrying that you're not on therapy because your cancer's growing? Are you having an adverse quality of life just because of that? You're worrying. And she was certainly along that line. She just, you know, the thought of growing cancer in her body was just too great for her not to. So without high-dose IL-2, we're in currently trial transition, and there's not a trial in my geographic region frontline for her, that we decided to proceed with sunitinib. And like my colleagues, I started off treatment with TKIs with a large experience with sunitinib. I've been involved in the clinical trials with pazopanib, so I have a very large experience of that. Over the past several years, I've preferentially used pazopanib as frontline therapy. It's only been recently that I've started going back to sunitinib, and I'm doing so with a little bit different thought process, and I'm using sunitinib initially on some of the emerging data from the Canadian group and from MD Anderson and Cleveland Clinic, looking at alternative dosing strategies as possibly being a way to tolerate, maintain dose intensity, reasons that Bob Figlin gave that he still uses sunitinib, the flexibility. So in this patient, I actually chose to proceed with sunitinib, but we went with the 50 milligram 4 week on, 2 week off schedule, just to kind of as a baseline. I haven't made that transition to just jump into the alternative dosing as the first cycle, but she developed toxicity. Some started to get grade 3 fatigue difficulty. So having that data reconfirmed at GU ASCO this year, the retrospective data set suggesting that patients could be on the dose 50 milligrams longer, less toxicity, potentially even hints of greater efficacy. I talked to her about that, and we went with the alternative dosing 2 week on, 1 week off. And so, you know, so far she had one scan done at 3 months, two cycles into therapy, and she's had about a 40% or so reduction in her target 3 big lesions that previously had grown. She had some of her smaller pulmonary nodules that were under 1 centimeter in size are no longer visible. And then she has a clustering of maybe 3 or 4 of those calcified nodules, which are still stable. And so she seems to be having a partial response early into her therapy. And she's now, I think, cycle 3 or for into treatment.
Dr. Quinn.
So I was interested in Tom's statement about the Canadian data, which I think we're all interested in, where they're giving 2 weeks of sunitinib at the standard 50 dose and then a week off, and we're certainly working with that. But there's also other suggested regimens, 2 days on, 1 day off, sort of a continuous situation. And I'm reticent to use that because in the renal effects study that Dr. Motzer led, where we gave 37.5 continuously versus the 50 for 4 weeks on, 2 weeks off, the patients didn't seem to get as good a disease control with continuous. And I just wonder what people thought about that. What level of evidence do we need to use these alternative dosing strategies, and which one do people use? Because community oncologists asked me about that.
Dr. Motzer, what would you have done with this lady hearing what happened in the first cycle?
Well, I think first I would have treated her with pazopanib. You know, I probably wouldn't have used sunitinib. And if I had used sunitinib, then I would have used it by the 4-2 schedule, because there's a long history of what to do and how to dose manage patients with the 4-2 schedule based on toxicity. My feeling is kind of once you get out of that, you don't really have the rules in the background to fall back on to make adjustments in toxicity.
So you would have dose reduced her? And kept her on the 4-2.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Figlin, how do you approach this issue of scheduling?
Yeah, I would have done exactly like Tom did. I appreciate Bob Motzer's conservative approach to using data to decide how to treat patients. But I would just say that we don't do a very good job in the kidney cancer space of rapidly asking questions and answering questions that are important for patients that might not be important for the sponsor. So although we may want an answer to the question of 4-2 versus 2-1, that may not be the question that the support mechanisms are interested in developing, because at the end of the day, what's the bottom line from their perspective? It's still using their drug. And I've actually seen over the course of my career, I'm sure we all have, opportunities where the community actually informs the academic institutions about how they might want to think about delivering therapies, because sometimes, in my view, we're a little bit too evidence-based, so to speak. So I would have done exactly what Tom did. I would have started at 50 milligrams, 4-2. And if there was toxicity that prevented me from continuing, I would have switched quickly to maintaining dose and changing schedule. And to David's point about these alternative schedules, I mean, I think there's enough, yes, admittedly, mostly retrospective data or not controlled data out there from a variety of groups in the literature that supports the 2-in-1 schedule that gives me some confidence around that space.
So would you do it up front? Would you start out that way?
And I appreciate that, and I've not gotten yet there to that, so to speak. I still really start them out on high-level evidence, phase 1 level evidence with the 50 milligrams, 4-2. And the reason I've not switched to pazopanib for individual reasons is I found the capability of switching to an alternative schedule, the toxicity modifying event that allows me to maintain dose. If I did not have that, I think moving to pazopanib would have made great sense.
Dr. Quinn.
I think we now have choice, and with choice comes challenges in that toxicity management paradigm, which we're talking about. If you manage one drug on a certain schedule and you have a sort of switch up that you can do, that's in quotes easy for the people that are working with you, and also sometimes the patients. The paradigm with pazopanib is different, and I'll switch across to pazopanib in certain situations. I have patients where when you go into the 2-week break, they've been on 3 antihypertensives and all of a sudden they're hypotensive. Or they have great variation in the way their thyroid responds to sunitinib, where it's actually the break's a problem. Now, a shorter break on 2-1 can help that. It's not as pronounced, but sometimes they need continuous dosing. I'm not confident with 37.5 of sunitinib each day, and I am actually confident with pazopanib each day, and I think it's a good treatment that they may still have the hypertension and the thyroid issues, but they're consistent and they're getting dosed each day.